So, as an introduction, we'll have a look at John chapter 20. We'll commence at verse 19. So, John chapter 20 and verse 19.
It's great to be here. It's good to see you. Cast my eyes over the masses, which is great to see so many here. And a couple of those, I remember picking on him last time. And I'm still going to pick on you. You've got a different top on, so I can't actually use the label, whatever it was. I can't remember it was.
Lonsdale,
that's what it was. Okay. All right. Now, I'm not sure where I've got that one there, because I don't want that particular one. In fact, I'm going to change my... change it. That was last week's, you see. Just checking to see if you're totally focused. Just bear with, as they say. All right, here it goes. And you'll see that it's very similar, but not the same. So here it is. Play the slideshow. Here it is. Right. Notice how the image is a bit bigger? Did you see that? No? Okay. All right. Very attentive, I can tell. All right. Now, with absolute certainty, this is something that we're really certain about, is that we believe that Jesus knew what was in man. And that's a generic term. I'm talking about men and women. So what was in man? And what's more, he knows exactly what's inside each one of us. And that's what I find absolutely amazing. And with unerring accuracy, he dealt with each person according to their needs, as he does ours. So it's according to their needs and our needs. He knew what they needed and not what they wanted necessarily. Okay, so he knows what we need and not what we want. You know, we want lots of things, but sometimes those lots of things we just don't need. And so it is with us. We need different treatment, don't we? We need to be looked at as individuals, and because looking at each one of you here, we're all different, dramatically different sometimes, and we know this to be the case, and we want it to be true, because it's the way we then deal with each other. We want to know the differences, we want to know the person, and we want to deal with them in the best way possible. You know, thinking about our children, I think about my children, and then I think about my grandchildren. And you all know Luke, and you know Julia, and you also know the twins, right? Frankie and Olive. Who doesn't know Frankie and Olive? Anyone here? No? You probably do. Frank, you don't. Okay, Frankie and Olive's their name. They're twins, they're four-year-old, and they're not identical. And what's more, they are not identical in so many different ways. Their whole personality is totally different. Their personality is different. They are affected by different things. They eat different things. They play differently. They relate to their parents differently as well. Okay, and it's the same for us. And when you think about it, as we go through our life, we realise that we have needs, and we also realise that those needs change as we go through our life at various stages. And but here's the point I want to make. No matter what our differences may be, all of us want as the most important thing, and that is to, the need is to be like Jesus Christ. That is the common need that we all have. And Jesus knows that, and God knows that, and he wants that in us. And so, of course, God works. He's doing this great job. It's a good work, and things happen for good. And that good is to be like Jesus. That's what God is doing with us. So by observing the apostles, what are we being taught? Well, there it is. And I could have gone through some of the others as well, but... you know, the Peters amongst us. Now, some of us are Peters, or certain traits of Peters, and it's that whole aspect of impetuosity, just knee-jerk reacting to things. Peter was a big guy, I believe, strong, great fisherman, and what's more, he often relied on that, and he was impetuous. He just thought, yeah, that's a great thing, or, hey, no, you can't do that, and he would just say things straight off the top of his head. And the Johns, well, they, you know, James and John, they were known as the Sons of Thunder. Well, they were intense individuals, really intense. And the Andrews had to see past inferiority after their big brother, Andrew's big brother, was Peter. He's up front. And so Andrew had to sort of work through the potential of being feeling like inferior to his big brother. And the Phillips had to surpass and overcome natural timidity. He was just a shy guy. He was the sort of person right at the back. And, you know, you look at him and just go, don't look at me. You know, like kids in the back row of a class. They're like, whatever you do, don't look at me and ask me a question. And then totally different. And then we find the Thomases have to overcome uncertainty. They were just trapped in their personality. Things were just so uncertain, and they were constantly processing this aspect of life around them. Everything was sort of uncertain, and they were just going, oh, I don't think so. It was like their first answer is no. Like, what do you think of that? No. Hey, isn't it a great day? You know what they're going to say? No, it's not. All right. So Jesus molded his men. So I love that whole concept of hands-on molding. And Jesus often had hands-on. He often laid his hands on his disciples. He would have been a great hugger, I think. Even in COVID, he probably would have sort of go, oh, well, you know, COVID, I'm prepared to hug lepers. I'll prepare to hug a COVID person. No problems. So consequently, it's interesting to see how he actually went through the process of teaching them. They started as just learners, disciples, just followers, yeah? And then they gradually went to being apostles. And it was something that was not natural to them. They didn't just grow up one day and say, well, I'm going to be an apostle. You know, I'm fishing now, but like tomorrow I'm just going to be an apostle. Like, yeah. No, it wasn't going to happen like that there. Jesus had to take them through their natural growth processes, all right? So, first of all, they lacked spiritual understanding. They just didn't get it. You know, at times they were amazingly thick-headed, they were dumb, and also blind. And Jesus says that in, you know, like if you want to write this down, Matthew 15, verse 15, you know, Peter says, Jesus, can you please explain the parable to us? And Jesus goes, oh, don't they get it? Are you still so dull? Jesus asked them. Look, don't you get what I'm trying to tell you? You're just so dull. And so Jesus' remedy, right, and that often is the case, even here, like just talking to you, you know, this form of presentation, I tend to use visuals and I tend to get you to read and I sort of talk and pull away from myself, but it's mainly up there, so that I can keep your attention going. And even then someone will just go, no, it's not doing it for me. All right? So Jesus' remedy, he just persisted. He just kept on going. He tried different techniques, different ways, different stories, different experiences. You know, suddenly there'd be a massive miracle. Next thing, there'd be in a storm, and Jesus is walking on the water, and then he's curing, you know, he's raising someone from the dead, and then he's hugging a leprous person. They were just like totally and utterly taken by that. And so he just persisted in teaching them right until the moment he ascended into heaven, right to that moment. And after that too, in Acts 1 verse 3, you know, he then gave them, it says, after his suffering, he presented himself to them and gave many, many convincing proofs that he was alive. I mean, they were still going like, is he really alive? Like, we've been there. And this Acts 1 is sometime later. It's almost, you know, like let's say getting close to 50 days later, possibly. All right, and he's sort of presenting themselves. He's talking to them. He's showing them. He just keeps on talking and show that he was alive. And he appeared to them over a period of 40 days, just constantly, constantly expanding things and speaking about himself and the kingdom of God. So thick-headed, like us. Like, we just don't get it at times. And they lacked humility. You know, these people that were going to be the main inspiration of ecclesias and brothers and sisters right through to our time, they just lacked humility. They were self-absorbed. It was all about me. You know, me. No. Like, and they wanted to, do things for themselves. And they constantly argued. Like, seriously, you know, they argued. I think about, coming into here, and if I suddenly came and saw, like, what's going on? That group's arguing over there, and they really are like, rather than just sort of stirring each other in the friendliest way, you know, like James and Catherine, like, they don't argue. They just stir each other mercilessly because they love each other. That's the reason. We understand that. Right. Well, that's my perspective. Someone else might have a different perspective, but no, I believe that's the case. And, you know, so here they are. They're constantly at each other. And Jesus' example, he goes, right, I'm going to deal with this. I'm going to deal with this in the most gentle way possible. And so he demonstrates. He doesn't say, hey, you guys, like, just stop it. And this is the reason. Da-da-da gives him all the theory. He goes, no, I'm going to show you an example of humility. And so we know the story and know the episode where he washes their feet. And we know that they just can't handle it. They just think, well, this is like, no. So he modelled servanthood and he humbled himself even right to the point of death on the cross just to show what it is to sacrifice oneself for another person. And then they lack faith. You think, well, surely they had a lot of faith. Like, I mean, really? And when you find, you know, four times in the Gospels of Matthew alone, Jesus says of them, O ye of little faith. You know, he's listening. He hears. He knows what's going on in their mind. He goes, yeah, you little faith. You know, what are you talking to each other about? Things like, where's the bread? Where's the food? You know, like, can't Jesus actually sort of do something about this? Here we are. We've got crowds around us. Where's the food? And he just goes, don't you get it? I can give you bread to actually fill your stomachs, but also I'm giving you bread that's something far beyond that. You just don't get it. And so Jesus' remedy, he's just doing more miracles. He just says, right. And we find in John 20, verse 30, Jesus performed many other, this is the last sort of verse there, Jesus performed many other signs in the presence of his disciples, which are not recorded in this book. Now, wouldn't it be awesome to be able to just figure out, like, what? I wish I could find what was recorded. What did he do? Because that would have been just fantastic. And he did that so that they realised that he was the Messiah and they would believe in his name. And then they lack commitment. Now, one of the great things, especially in life, you'll find, is that you can be the most brilliant person on planet Earth. I've taught a few geniuses in my time, and some of the geniuses have had commitment, and others were like, whatever, you know. Don't you like that term, whatever? Yeah, whatever. So you're bright, you're brilliant, you're a wonderful person, and why don't you do something with it? Where's your commitment? Oh, you know, like, I'll wing it. I'll get through the exam. I'll just, like, I won't study all night through midnight for that jolly maths test. Yeah, look, I'm brilliant. I will just wing it. No, not the case. And so Jesus realised that they were going to just leave him. They weren't going to be committed because they, under pressure, that's where things are going to fall apart. And so Jesus, we know in John 17, he just prays. He goes to his Father in prayer and he says, look, I want you, Heavenly Father, to protect them. This is what I want. In John 17, verse 11 to 12, he says, I will remain in the world no longer, but they are still in the world. And I am coming to you, Holy Father, protect them by the power of your name, the name you gave me, so that they may be one as we are one. While I was with them, I protected them and kept them safe by that name you gave me, you see. So here's Jesus praying. He knows what's going to happen. He knows what they were like. He knows exactly the massive sort of tsunami type of effect that Jesus being arrested is going to happen to them. And he already knew that. And they lacked power and were weak too. They just couldn't tap into the power that Jesus was offering them. And you know, when he sent them out, they came back, and the people that needed help weren't helped by the disciples because they just didn't actually really appreciate what had been given to them. And of course, Jesus' remedy later on, he gave them the power of the Holy Spirit. And that was to indwell and empower them. And in Acts 1 verse 8 it says, "But ye will receive power when the Holy Spirit comes on you, and you will be my witnesses in Jerusalem and in all Judea and Samaria and to the ends of the earth." So Jesus knew that they needed that incredible support system put into place because they were still learners, even though they were apostles. They still had a big journey to go through. So Jesus knows, as I said, and what's more, he knows the way we look at things often affects greatly our responses in life and our attitude. So the way we view, the way our personality gets us to view things or things in our life that have affected us, we view life through those glasses, right? And if those glasses have been somehow had filters on them through life, we view our life through those glasses. Now, that makes sense, doesn't it? That's the way it is. So consequently, it affects the quality of our life. So if we see things in a negative way, our whole life is just going to be swayed. So our mindset, if it is a negative mindset, it's just going to affect us. It's just going to pull us down. And we need to have a positive mindset that Jesus and God are prepared to give us, which is reality. It's like, hey, guess what? People, you are people. You're human beings. Just get over the fact that that's what you are, and things are going to happen in your life, and you've just got to start viewing things through my eyes and how to actually manage that life of yours. Now, you know Eeyore, yeah? Have you heard of Eeyore? You all have? You've read it? You probably still read it, do you? Yeah? Why not? That's so cute. Anyway, so Eeyore, as we know, is a character in the Winnie the Pooh books by A.A. Milne, and he's generally characterised as a pessimistic, gloomy, depressed, old grey stuffed donkey. What a great character to actually present. Who, like, don't you? That description is just it, isn't it? An old grey stuffed donkey. Now, none of us are like this, I'm sure. Okay, who is a friend of the title character, Winnie the Pooh? Now, the Winnie the Pooh, he says, "Lovely day, isn't it?" to Pooh. And you know what Pooh says? "Well, if it is a good morning, which I doubt." So the question then is, how does an Eeyore personality process everyday life? You know, they're trapped in their personality. How do they actually process every day? What about major happenings? How do they then process it where they can't even cope with a lovely day? They go, yeah, well, if you say it's a good day, you know, like James in his prayer sort of commented about what a great day it is. It is, but someone said, but it's too hot, you know, like, oh, really, you know. I like it about 24, but it got to 28. You know, like, seriously? It's just ridiculous, isn't it? So that would be an Eeyore character. Now, what about major happenings? Well, what about, say, the COVID-19 situation? Imagine Eeyore coping with what we cope with. You know, the outlook of the pessimist. If you think it's bad now, just wait. Like, if you think COVID's bad now, just wait and see where it's heading. I know where it's heading. So that's the pessimist. The realist says, well, so what? life goes on. Like if it's here, life will go on. It might be different, but life will go on. The optimist, oh, come on, it can't be that bad. That's me. I'm like, hey, really? No, it's not that bad. Now, yeah, it's interesting. The pessimist argues that it was only his bleak forecasts that changed behaviours, and that without such changes, the optimist's obviously faulty data and poor reasoning would have led policymakers over a cliff. So he says, yeah, but you need me. You need me as a pessimist just to get your act together because you're just off with the fairies. You know, you're floating on cloud nine. We pessimists are really great people and we know what it's all about and we are saving you, optimists, and also we're helping you, realists. Interesting, isn't it? So the point, though, is there's a fault in the reasoning, and the fault is that the Eeyores and all the others, including the optimists, don't have all the information. So they can't make that judgment anyway. They can't see, the world is going to fall apart. We're doomed. And you go, well, where do you get that information from? Oh, you know, like, I've got Google. Like, seriously, advertiser. I know what's going on in the advertiser. And, you know, and the optimists, yeah, but I have the Sydney Morning Herald and they are da-da-da. So, you know, and the whole thing is, you see how the whole thing is to do with, the thing is all sides can overreact in the worst way possible and cause a disaster either way. So the Eeyore syndrome, you know, there is the upside of pessimists, as I mentioned here. The upside of pessimism is that pessimists use their negative expectations to motivate them to take active steps to feel prepared and be more in control of outcomes. So they will be the ones that go, toilet paper, man, like, I've just got to buy a ton of it. Well, I've just got to go, you know, and get it. And because they already know what's going to happen if they don't get it. There'll be a world shortage and the whole lot. So they're already in control. They're going to be the ones that roll up with their trolleys and just completely decimate all the marketplaces, right? So, but being a pessimist isn't necessarily bad, though it may irritate others. Like, pessimists aren't bad people. Like, we don't go around hating them. Like, you just go, yeah, we've got pessimists in our media. I hate them. Like, seriously? You can't go around hating pessimists. And I love optimists and realists. Well, you know, I'm not sure whether I like them or not. You know, like, you just go, really? So ultimately, it's what you do that as a pessimist that matters. If you are a pessimist, if you have that leaning, you've got to realise it's going to colour. You've got to be a realist here, if you can, and it's going to colour all aspects of your life. Everything will be put into doubt. You'll doubt everything. And as a result, it could lead to a very sad conclusion and it could be very damaging consequences. And it can affect you and those around you. All right. So now that we had this sort of big intro, which is really interesting, it gives you sort of a lead into how Jesus was moulding Thomas. You could probably, not Didymus, but it could be Thomas Eeyore Didymus. Or it could be a whole heap of stuff. All right. So Thomas was this character. And so Jesus was now going to mould Thomas from anxious pessimism. He was constantly anxious to a realistic optimist. He's going to move him towards that sort of position, and it's going to happen. Jesus is going to change his particular person. Now, and we know that extremely pessimistic individuals are real challenges. I have a few that I have come across, and like I don't know what to do with them because it's just beyond me. I don't understand them at all. And I'd become a little bit sort of cynical and I'm like, yeah, really, you know, like, you're off the planet, you know, you've got things going wrong here. And so I really don't know how to handle them, but Jesus did. You know, there's absolutely no doubt that Jesus loved Thomas and helped him to grow beyond his negative perspective. Jesus loved him. He didn't go, oh, that's just Thomas. You guys, look, just, you know, it's Thomas. I know how you feel about him, and don't write him off. You know, I love him and I want him to grow. Now, we know on two occasions Jesus was threatened to be stoned, right? And mainly in Jerusalem, where he was in a situation, and not just Jesus, but those around him would have been in that same situation, you know, like his followers, but Jesus especially. And we find, you know, those two major passages in John 8:59 and John 10, verse 31 to 42, much the same, where, you know, Jesus finds himself in a situation where he's confronted by the rulers and what he says to them, they just go ballistic and they just grab rocks and they're just going to stone him. And he slips away from the temple grounds. He just goes away. And again, the same thing happened. And then Jesus escapes. Finally, he just says, right, I've got to get out of here because it's not my time. I've just got to get out. If I stay around, I'm just going to be killed too soon. So he goes across to the eastern bank of the Jordan near Jericho. And some people say Bethabara, others say Bethabara. Depends on which side of the torrents or which side of Jordan you exist on. So whichever you prefer, Bethabara or Bethabara. What sounds better for you? Which would you prefer? How do you say it? How do you say it? Bethabara. I like it. It's good. It's got a sort of a slight sort of extra syllable in it, which is nice. Bethabara. It's nice. It's a bit like Barbara, isn't it? Bethabara, but it's Bethabara. All right, so anyway, now he goes across there and the ministry in the wilderness was phenomenal. It was just this phenomenal success and there's no opposition whatsoever. So the other side, everybody just loved Jesus. And it was such a contrast to Judea and Jerusalem. And as a result, we find that in that place, many believed in Jesus. Many believed in Jesus. And now while he's there, he's sort of in this lovely, safe environment. His disciples around him and, you know, and they're feeling really just great. And the news of Lazarus came to Jesus. And things are going to change dramatically because the apostles panic, absolutely panic. So, you know, John 11, if you want to just flick over a couple of pages there. So John 11, flick a few pages backwards.
So yeah. Interestingly, I think Sam next week is looking at Lazarus.
I'm not going to cover. So you're okay. I'm not going to cover anything. I'm just going to just throw it out there. And you can use anything I've got up there.
Yeah, I'm copying all this now.
I've noticed. All right. So anyway, so what's happened is we know the story really, really well, and you know, the message comes, you know, your friend, your close friend is ill, and, you know, we need you here. And Jesus just goes, I'm just going to explain to my disciples, you know, my apostles, that this is the situation, and they're beginning really agitated already. They just go, yeah, well, what are you going to do, Jesus? Are you thinking of actually going back to Jerusalem? You know, getting close to Bethany, only about 3 km out of Jerusalem? Is that where you think of going? And they're just going to full-on panic mode. They just go, like, no. You know, Rabbi, they say, John 11, verse 8. You know, they go into full protective mode. They go, Rabbi, the Jews were just now seeking to stone you, and are you going there again? Like, seriously? Are you thinking of going back there? Right? And, you know, what's more, they're voicing exactly what, you know, so it's not just one person, but all of them are voicing. Peter, especially later on, voices that as well, doesn't he? He says, like, there's no way. Steps in front of Jesus, says, you're not going there. And Jesus said, just get behind me. You know, you're blocking my way. Just get behind me. And so it's exactly the same thing. And it's wonderful when you actually see what Jesus says, because You know, it's wonderful to witness Jesus's, and you know, he's anticipating their reactions, and he calms them down. But he uses a strange set of thoughts there, the way he calms them down. And he says, look, really, well, what he just is going to say is, he just says, you're not going to be harmed. And you know, in verse 9, he says it this way. And he uses just this simple, very pointed analogy. If you have a look at verse 9, Jesus answered, are there not 12 hours in the day? And you think, well, what's he talking about? Like, why is he saying this? You know, like suddenly they're all freaking out. You know, they're panicking. And, you know, they want to protect Jesus. And Jesus goes, look, are there not 12 hours in the day? If anyone walks in the day, he does not stumble. Oh, okay. Because he sees the light of this world. Sure, I understand. But if anyone walks in the night, he stumbles because the light is not in him. And you go, it's pretty logical. What's he saying? Why is he saying that, do you think? Well, he's saying, I am the light. My dear friends, he says, I am the light, and also I am the day of hope and salvation. So I am giving you a day of hope and a day of salvation. If you are with me, if you are, you'll not stumble because I'm the light. So stick with me. I'm the light. Those that will stumble have not me. They just don't want me, and they, no matter what they try to do, they will be the ones that stumble because they're not with me. They walk in the blackness of night. So he's saying, look, you're okay. If you're with me, we're in the light. We're being protected by the light. You know, God's around us. Stay with us. Stay with me. And then the question is, well, did they believe him? Did they really understand what he's saying? Like if someone said that to you, would you go, I'm not sure what you mean? So they didn't really understand either. And they really didn't really believe that everything is going to be okay, because as we know, later on Jesus says, well, you know, and we know the story. Yeah, they think that Jesus is talking about the fact that he's just sick. And like, seriously, why go there if he's sick? Like, he'll get better. You don't go into enemy territory, as it were, to be killed, to just help someone who's sick. Right, we know that, right? But he just lays it on him. He says, no, sorry. He's dead. And we must go. We must go because I'm going to do something amazing. And it's going to glorify God. We must go. And they go, okay. They realize, yep, there's no way that we're going to change Jesus' decision to go. He was determined to do so. And so in verse 16, we are introduced to Thomas. Well, you know how Thomas is going to react, don't you? Okay. And so Thomas, as you can see there, his Hebrew name was Thomas, and his Greek name was Didymus, which means the twin. And of course, I've got questions like, is he twin? Has he got brothers or sisters? Who are his brothers? Or is he a sister? Or is there something else happening there? You know, it's all good debate, you know, like ask James, he'll fill you in on that. You know, just, you know, like, is like, who could be twin? Could he be like, who is he near? Matthew seems to be close by. Could it be Matthew? Could it be his twin? You know, like, oh, you know, there's all this sort of stuff that you could present. All right, anyway, but that's something that you can talk about. Or is there a sense of a, like, has he got a double personality? Yeah, like, I like that concept, that he's got this double personality, like he's marvelously loyal to Jesus, yet he's terribly unsure. So there's loyalty and unsurety, like, how loyal can I be? I'm not sure. You know, like, I'm a bit unsure how loyal I could be to Jesus. And we find that Matthew, Mark, and Luke tell us nothing about Thomas except his name. However, John is the one that defines him more clearly in his gospel. So here we go. So what happens then? We know the story. He's the heroic pessimist. See, suddenly things change. Change of title. I like to give this slightly change of title. So pessimist, but now there's heroic. So there's that double personality side, the Didymus side coming through, the twin, like, yeah. Okay, so he's heroic, but he's a pessimist. All right, that's an interesting contrast there. So we read in verse 16, so Thomas called the twin, said to his fellow disciples, "Let us also go, that we may die with him." Well, there you go. You know, like, hey, I'm a hero, but also I think I'm going to die at the same time. Like, yeah, that's a way to go. Let's just do it. So he was a pessimist. In some ways, he was the group pessimist. He just spoke for the group. They all thought that. They, you know, like he was a spokesman. Hey, Jesus, I'm voicing this, but we all think the same. You know, no doubt he voiced the anxiety of the others. Yet he was very logical. You'll find he's got this logical yet skeptical type of mind. He says, well, logically, if we do go there, guess what's going to happen? We're going to die. Logic. Okay. And he had a form of sort of this courageous loyalty which inspired the rest of the apostles, because they said, okay, yeah, I think we'll follow you. They didn't hate Thomas. They saw him as being like way out there, but he convinced them, didn't he, to go. He said, look, let's go. You with us? You with Jesus? I'm with Jesus. What about you guys? Yeah, okay, let's go. If it means we die, we die. But we love Jesus and we're going to go there. And so, yes, he was angst-ridden. He was totally full of uncertainty. He was anticipating the worst all the time. So you can see him anticipating all this. He had these deep, deep doubts, but also he had strong courage and great loyalty and a great love for Jesus. Because he's saying, if that's where Christ is, let us go with him. That's the best place to be. And in life, that is the best place to be. If I'm struggling and, you know, like, just, you know, like on death's door, literally at times, if Jesus is with me, that's the place for me to go. And I'm prepared to actually go there. So important. Did he understand and was he comforted by Jesus' words of walking in the light? I don't know whether he understood that. Did he believe that Jesus was going to be killed so soon? Well, did any of them? Well, no, they really didn't. They didn't get it. They thought, well, possibly, because they've already experienced the stoning, but like crucifixion, like that didn't. Like, what are you talking about? They didn't get it at all. All they knew is past experiences. And, you know, deep down, even the greatest pessimist can have a spark of hope. It's like, yeah, well, let's go. We may die with him, but, like, I hope we don't, sort of thing. All right? So I hope not, but let's go. Now, the second occasion of Thomas is in John 14, verse 46. And we know, too, that in the previous chapter, you know, like in chapter 13, verse 33, Jesus is already spelling out his imminent death. He's saying to them constantly, I'm going to die. I'm going to die. And it's really soon, because, you know, John's record is really compressed to sort of some of the last days of his life. And so consequently, he's telling them, he says in verse 33 of John 13, little children, yet a little while I am with you, you will seek me. And just as I said to the Jews, so now I also say to you, where I am going, you cannot come. So he's laying the groundwork, isn't he? He's just saying, this is what's going to happen. And then John 14, verse 1, Jesus goes on and says, let not your heart be troubled. So he's calming them down. He's just trying to, you know, really give them hope. You believe in God? And they say, yes. Believe also in me. In my Father's house are many mansions. And here's he's really talking about. He's not talking about mansions. He's really talking about, like, a big family, like, we've got big families. God's got big families, you know, like mansion families. And if it were not so, I would have told you, I go to prepare a place for you, and if I go and prepare a place for you, I will come again and receive you to myself. And where I am, there you may be also. Where is he? Like, he's creating a family. And I'm just creating this space for you in the family, the big family. And where I go, you know, and the way you know. So he said, you know where I'm going. Look, I've been telling you all the time. They go, yeah. And Thomas says, you know, he voices it. Like he looks around and he says, you know where I'm going, don't you? Like, my friends, like Peter, you know where I'm going. Like, Philip, Andrew, James, you know where I'm going. And Thomas goes, Lord, we don't know. Like, we don't know where you're going. And how can we know the way? Like we just don't know. And the question then has to be posed, well, where was Jesus going? Because they didn't know. What was he trying to tell them constantly? Well, where he was going, he was trying to tell them that he was walking towards a sacrificial death in loving obedience to his Father's will. And it was a positive walk. It was one of triumph, not defeat. One of salvation and everlasting life. So he was going on this triumphant walk. You know, it was just a positive walk. But they didn't get it. You know, like Thomas goes, well, we don't know. Well, like, what are you saying? I don't know. Because this whole concept of moving and walking towards a sacrificial life was Thomas's worst nightmare. You know, he was angst-ridden and pessimistic and now grappling with the concept of trials and sacrifice and death overwhelmed him. It's like, you know, we come into the truth and we think, well, everything's just going to be cruisy, like seriously easy sailing. And someone like a realist will say, like, it's not going to be. You know, life is just going to be, like, seriously tough. You're going to be mangled. It's going to be a life of sacrifice. And the Thomases will go, well, I couldn't cope with that. I just don't want to hear it. Don't talk to me about that. I want it to be sort of clear sailing. And Jesus is saying, well, it's not. But I'm there with you all the way. So Jesus comforts Thomas and the other apostles in verse 1, as we said, let not your hearts be troubled. And we find that when he goes through, he says he himself is walking the path first and opening, clearing it for all those who want to follow. So Jesus is the forerunner. He's the one that's, you know, running and clearing the path and making things easier, even though people are still going to find life tough. He's the one that's going first. And he's saying to Thomas, you will not be left alone, Thomas. My Father's love and mine will always be with you. We will always be there for you, Thomas. And the same assurance is for us. Now, that's the great thing. It's exactly the same thing that Jesus would be saying to his apostles and to Thomas. We will not be left alone either. We have the way, we believe that. We have the truth, and we have life. We have our Father in heaven, and we have Jesus beside us. That's what Jesus is saying. You know, like, we're there with you all the way. Now, we arrive at the time when Jesus is arrested in the garden. And Jesus sees that they all forsook him and fled. You know, we know they just got, you know, we're out of here. We can't cope. We just can't cope. All our dreams, aspirations have been totally and utterly mangled. And you can imagine Thomas, you know, his heart's bursting. He's absolutely bursting with confusion, fear and despair, isn't he? Probably out of all the disciples, he was most badly affected. Like, he's just going. And he was prone to crash into this brooding, depressed form of thinking. You can imagine him just sinking. He was saying, well, all is lost. You know, my life's gone. Everything's lost. My hopes are gone. Everything's been shattered. I knew it, Eli. I just kept on saying to her, it's not good. It's, you know, just I knew it, and now it's happened. What do I do now? And that's Thomas. He's going, well, It's gone. All my hopes are gone. I'm just totally mangled. What do I do now? And they were all shattered, weren't they? You know, they fled. They were petrified and felt absolutely threatened with being captured. They just, like, they're after us. They just went. And they were worried that they were going to be killed and possibly their families were going to suffer as well. So they were just totally beside themselves. They were confused. They didn't understand. Like, they just, like, you know, all of Jesus' constant and precise revelations had not connected. They just did not understand. They were confused. They were disappointed. I mean, that's like an understatement. Disappointed? Oh, they were totally and utterly disappointed. Their hopes were shattered. They were disillusioned with their relationship with Jesus. Well, yeah, he was our master. We followed him. We listened. We believed everything he said. Was he just another man with this, like, overzealous set of ideas? Like, is that who he was? Like, he's been arrested and he's going to be killed. And as a result, they felt totally abandoned, betrayed by one of their own. Like, they thought Judas was their, you know, like their mate. They're part of the team, part of, you know, the whole group where they talked and spent time and they supported each other. And suddenly to find that they were betrayed by one of their own, Judas. How could he? Like, why did he do it? Like, why? He was one of us. And they were heartbroken because they loved Jesus. They absolutely loved Jesus. They were traumatized by his arrest. And what's more, they loved each other as well because they thought, well, what do we do to support each other through this? And the question is, what will they do now? And so we know Jesus appeared to the disciples. We know the story, Mary Magdalene first, and then she raced off and said that she'd seen the Master, and she told them everything that occurred. And later on that day, we know too that the disciples gathered themselves together, didn't they? But they were fearful of the Jews. They had locked the doors, absolutely locked the doors in the house, but Jesus entered into the house and stood among them. And you can imagine they're like, whoa, this is... And he says, peace to you. Then he showed them his hands and his side, and they were just totally and utterly amazed. So verse 20 says, the disciples seeing the Master with their own eyes were exuberant. In other words, they were totally over the top, you know, totally over the top happy, full of energy, excitement and cheerfulness. And then verse 24, but Thomas was not with them. He's not there because that's the reaction of a pessimist. He's plunged into despair. He's isolated himself. He's brooding. He's totally depressed. He was brokenhearted. He was shattered. He was devastated. He was crushed. He just wanted to be alone. He was in no mood to be in a crowd, even with his closest friends. That's Thomas. Now, some of us have been there. Yes. Some of us, you know, like, that's us. Sometimes, like, things, just leave me alone. I can't cope. You know, just don't come near me. Don't talk to me. I just cannot handle this at all. So where did Thomas go? What did he do? And the question then for us is, where do we go when we are really down? What do we do? Where do we go? Do we want someone to help? You see? Those questions. This is us. Like, what happens to us? You know, for Thomas, alone, self-isolation was the worst place for him to be. He was in the clutches of his own personality, wasn't he? He's suddenly right in the worst. He's suddenly been just grabbed by his personality. What he needed most was caring company to balance and stabilize his extremely shattered and biased mind. He needed that company, even though he couldn't actually go into the company, but he needed it. And he needed to redirect his thoughts to others, his close companions. He had to just go, it's not about me anymore. I've got to think about my companions. How were they coping? They were in the same position as me. How are they coping? Could he do it? No, he couldn't. Could he help them in some ways? No, he couldn't. And that's the exhortation for us, isn't it? Like, we must be aware of where help really lies. We've got to know where we can get it, even though sometimes when we're in that situation, we just can't even manage to even contemplate that. And we have to accept that that's the case, but still know that there's help available. And we must be caring and sensitive of others and act on it. So we find in John 20, verse 25, Thomas is found. Wow. Whew, relief. But the disciples present this wonderful news of Jesus and his resurrection to Thomas, but it's not enough to convince him. They say, oh, yeah, I don't believe you. And he goes on, I will never, never believe until I can see, touch, and thrust my hand into his side. You know the story. He goes, no, I've got to be there, and I've just got to really just be there, hands on. I've got to actually put my hand into Jesus' side. You know, so Thomas was blinded, wasn't he, by an overload of hurt and negativity. He just like, I'm too hurt, and I just don't even want, I just can't cope with what you're asking me to do. He was still being a hopeless pessimist. His exuberant, ecstatic friends who were just bubbling over, you know, were not going to cheer him up that easily. He wasn't going to be cheered up by anybody. You know, like, have a great day. No. Like, have a little bit of a good, no. Like, no. Well, what about, would you like a coffee? No. No. Donut? No. No. None of that. Couldn't, wouldn't work. And it, when you think about it, after 8 days of support and allowing his ragged grief to ease a bit, he relented to join the group. He goes, and it took a long time, 8 days. And it takes time. It takes enormous and often painful mind struggles to gain balance. You know, to gain balance, to just to start balancing what's going on in life. Because there's the fear of being hurt. You know, Thomas goes like, but if it's not right, if it's not true, I'm just going to be shattered. I just can't cope with the thought of being hurt again. Sometimes with broken relationships, it's like that, isn't it? Like, why don't you start another relationship? You know, no, I can't cope with the thought of that going wrong. I'm going to be too hurt. You know, surrendering one's heart again would be so difficult for Thomas. And his fellow friends knew that what he was like and managed to gently coax him back. And at times we need fellow friends just like Thomas's friends, don't we? So Jesus knew what was in Thomas. He knew his grief, totally understood, and it was based on his love for him. Jesus tenderly, without judgment, invites Thomas to touch his wounds. Thomas, come here. Rather than like, seriously, Thomas, don't you get it? Like, I'm here. He said, just come here. Just put your hands into my side. Now, he didn't thrust his fingers into the Lord's wounds. He knew it was Christ. He knew. Thomas finally understood and believed who Jesus was. And, you know, it's interesting if you sort of flick over just very briefly, probably the last passage, just come over to Zechariah 13. You can have a look at Zechariah 12 and 13, and you know it's all about Israel, and you know Israel is just going to be absolutely mortified to realize that they were the ones that crucified Christ, and they're going to weep. And in verse Zechariah 13, you'll find in verse 9, it says, and this is interesting, and we know this section, it's sort of the second wave of Israel being attacked by the nations around. The first wave is in Zechariah 12, where all the neighbouring family tribes attack. Second phase is in verse 13, chapter 13, so forth. Anyway, I will bring the one-third through the fire. We will refine them as silver is refined. We know the story. And test them as gold is tested. They will call on my name. I will answer them. I will say, this is my people. And each one will say, the Lord is my God. In essence here, Jesus is calling Thomas, and Thomas is responding. He suddenly realizes. And Thomas, who feels as if he's come through, you know, utter destruction, you know, not just part of his twin was, you know, not 50%, but two-thirds of him somehow was decimated. Only one-third of him is left, more or less. And so with absolute joy and awesome wonder, he exclaims, my Lord and my God. Jesus, you are truly the Son of God. I totally believe you are truly the Son of God. You are my Lord. And suddenly Thomas's melancholy, comfortless, negative, moody tendencies were forever banished. And in that moment, he was transformed into a positive and courageous apostle and brother of Christ. Last one here, we know this so well. It's the last of the Beatitudes, I believe. And it's verse 29. Jesus says to Thomas, "Have you believed because you have seen me? Blessed are those who have not seen and yet have believed." You know that blessed are ye, blessed are, well, here it is. Blessed are ye, or those who have not seen and yet have believed. You know, even though he said the greatest blessing is for those who can believe without seeing, it's hard to imagine that there's a believer anywhere that would have not have wished that they could have been there with Jesus. You know, like, we would have loved to have been there and traded places with Thomas, given the chance to see Jesus face to face and hear Jesus' voice and being able to touch, you know, those ruined hands of his. You know, we would have loved to have been there, but it's not to be. You know, and the lesson there is, unfortunately, sight often crushes and crusts over spiritual things. It actually changes the concept of faith. Like, if you can see it, why have faith? Like, it's there. I can see it. So it actually changes the whole aspect of faith. Simple faith, however, goes in at once to the heart and core of things. It's this simple faith. I believe. We believe Jesus. We believe what we can read and understand and see in people. We believe. And we have this rock-solid belief structure by reading and thinking and contemplating what Jesus does with his men and women of faith. So, we've only tackled one apostle. Sometime in the future, James will tackle the other umpteen. And if he remembers, maybe to ask me, maybe in the future, when I say no, it'll actually be yes.